Okay, so welcome everybody. So you know what happened on the sixth day of the creation of the world? God said to the angels, he gathered them all together, and he said, today I'm going to create a land called Israel. And it's going to be a land of mountains full of snow. It's going to have sparkly lakes and forests and all kinds of trees in the forest. It's going to have high cliffs overlooking sandy beaches, an abundance of sea life, and I'm going to make the land rich so its inhabitants will prosper, and I'll call the inhabitants Israeli. And they'll be known to all the people on the earth. They'll be in the news every single day. They'll be front and center, very prominent. So the angels turn to God and they say, but Lord, don't you think you're being too generous to these Israelis? So God replies, not really. Just wait and see the neighbors I'm going to give them. So the topic of today is... welcome. The topic of today is, what do the Arabs really think of the Jews? So I'll start off with a story. I'll start off with a story that I experienced when I took a group of Canadians, members of my congregation, on a mission to Israel. And we ended up with a meeting this very fascinating guy. He was an ex-Brooklyn, he was from Brooklyn, what do they call him, Brooklynite?
Brooklyn.
Yeah, he was an ex-Brooklynite, and he was a soldier, and an ambulance driver, and a policeman, and what else, fireman, so like, you know, the kids really loved him, and he was pretty interesting for the adults as well. And he told us a story that happened during the first Lebanon War, which he fought in that war. And it was a very fascinating story that stuck in my mind, and I've thought about it a lot. And the story is that he went to... the Israelis had received intelligence on the other side, north of the border, in Lebanon, that there was a certain individual whose car was booby-trapped, and they were going to set that there was a, if the intelligence was true, that there was a chance that the car could explode and could kill him. So they went, as a courtesy, the Israeli soldiers, when they received this intelligence, they went to this man to warn him of the impending danger. They knocked on his door, and through an interpreter in Arabic, they told him that there's a chance that your car could explode. And the man said, called his son, you know, he said, Ahmed, get over here. So his son comes over, 14-year-old son, and he says, go underneath the car and poke it to see if something explodes. And he sends his son there. So the Israelis think that he didn't understand what they said. So they like jump in front of the boy to protect him, and they go, no, 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 kaboom, you know, and they make with their, they show their hands, you know, kaboom, explosion, boom, boom. The man turns to them in perfect Hebrew. He says, you think I didn't understand you? You think that's the problem? He said, well, let me tell you, my car is my status symbol. It is the most precious thing that I own. It's what makes me unique in this village, is that I own a car. A kid you can pop out in 5 minutes, but a car is something really precious and valuable. And a child is nothing. And, you know, he just kind of told us that story, the throwaway story. But it stuck in my head. Well, it's a pretty dramatic story. And what stuck in my head is that, you know, I am now a father. I was then as well. I'm now a more experienced father. And I can tell you, I would give my own life in a heartbeat if it meant saving my children's life. And I certainly wouldn't do anything consciously to place my children in harm's way. But what I realized is that not all cultures look at children in the same way. And in fact, not all cultures look at anything in the same way. So cultures have different viewpoints. There's a Talmudic statement which is very fascinating. Talmud speaks of Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was one of the great sages of the Talmud. And when anybody suffered a loss and he would go and comfort the bereaved, he had a standard line that he would use to comfort people who were in mourning. And that was, he wore around his neck a necklace, and there's some discrepancy exactly what he wore on the necklace. One opinion was that it was a tooth. Another opinion was it was a bone fragment. But whatever it was, he would walk into the house of mourning, and he would say, you think it's bad that you lost your mother, father, or whatever, a sibling. So that's nothing. This, either bone fragment or tooth, belongs to the 10th son that I buried. Like, you know, I had 10 sons that died, and this tooth belongs to the 10th one that I buried. Now, I have been on a few pastoral counseling courses where they teach rabbis how to do bereavement counseling. And one thing they teach you in all these courses, not that I think I had to be taught this, I think this was just common sense, but some people don't have this as common sense. It's not so common, yes. Thank you. Is that when you go and you counsel or comfort somebody who's suffered a loss, the last thing they need to hear is about somebody else's loss. Right. You've got to be there for them at that moment and be a support for them in their time of grief, and they're really not in a state where they can handle somebody else's grief as well. So you don't come and say, you lost your beloved mother, that's nothing. I lost 10 sons, you know, and this is the bone fragment of my 10th son. That would probably not pass in a I hope it shouldn't pass in the modern bereavement counseling context. So what's the Talmud saying? And it was very comforting. Again, we have to understand that we are Western, we have a Western outlook on life, and it trains us to think of events and incidents in certain ways. So we think of death in a certain way, and we think of life in a certain way, and we think of our, but that, just because we think in a certain way, and even maybe project our thoughts onto other people, that doesn't mean all people at all times always thought exactly as we do. So in Talmudic times, they had a different take on death, and this is just my own grappling and trying to understand this Talmudic statement, and how they could derive tremendous comfort. And so I think that in Talmudic times, the culture taught people that if you suffered a loss, if you suffered a tragedy, people naturally assumed that they had done something wrong spiritually, that they had fallen from grace, if you will, in God's eyes, and therefore they needed to be punished in this way. So when the greatest rabbi alive, Rav Yochanan, leader of the Jewish people, comes to a home that has suffered a tragedy, and he says, don't think it's you, because look at me, I'm the top Jew, right? I'm the top rabbi in the world, and I have suffered tragedy, so it's not a reflection of who you are. That was very comforting for them in their time and with their outlook and with their perception and how they understood life. So our understanding, we would be horrified by that. If somebody would walk into a Shiva home today and would say a statement like that, people would correctly be horrified, because our culture, that would be a very insensitive thing to say. But in 2,000 years ago, in Talmudic times, to say something like that would be considered a great source of comfort. So all we need to understand, I don't understand it, I don't relate to that, but I do understand that they're different than me. That's the point that you need to take from this Talmudic passage, that they don't think like I think. And I want to extend that to the fact that in the world today, there are cultures that do not think like I think. And it could be potentially very dangerous if I project my way of thinking onto other cultures and therefore have certain expectations from those cultures, which are constantly surprise me that they don't behave in the ways that I would anticipate based on my cultural conditioning. So the title is, What Do the Arabs Really Think of the Jews? And my main take-home message is obviously that they, as a culture, and I am generalizing, of course there are, you know, I'll give the standard caveat that there are many incredibly wonderful exceptions to any rule, but obviously, you know, I'm just going to give one caveat that I'm generalizing, and of course therefore I'm not accurate, and there are exceptions, but I don't want to keep saying that because we're not going to get anywhere. So at the risk of generalizing, the Arab mentality, the Arab mind, as Rafael Patai called it, the Arab mind is a different mind than the Western mind. And it's different in radically, it's radically different. It's a total different mindset. And if we are to survive as a society, Western culture is to survive, and it is under tremendous threat at the moment, and it's not a guarantee that our culture will survive. But if we are to survive, then one of the most important and first steps is that we have to understand that people are different. You know, there was a guy who wrote a book called Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and he made millions of dollars off that book, and the public speaking, etc., etc. And basically, you know, you can distill the book into one sentence: men and women are different.
Well, that's read.
You could give me millions of dollars. I just said it. There you go. So obviously, that's my message: that different cultures, different religions, are different. And you know, I from Canada, which we're like just north of America. With the hat of America.
Aren't you a state of America?
don't get controversial here. that's a lot of people lump us together, both Americans, never Canadians, but Americans would consider it probably a state of America and most of the rest of the world. But there are huge differences. Like anyone who makes a generalization and says Canadians and all North Americans are the same, it's an inaccurate portrayal, I can tell you that. All right, so what do we know about the Arab mind, what Patai called the Arab mind? What do we know about it? Well, unfortunately, most of what we know, we glean from television news, from newspaper articles, and these are in turn authored and created by people with the same kind of Western mindset as us, and they don't necessarily understand some fundamental differences. So there's a very interesting paper. It was written by General Edward Badalato in the States, and it was called Learning to Think Like an Arab Muslim, A Short Guide to Understanding the Arab Mentality. It's about, 18 pages. It was commissioned by the United States Army, I think, in the 70s. And it's a very interesting paper, and in there Badalato says that the Arab concept of the world could be viewed as a series of seven concentric circles. So at the middle of the concentric of these circles, at the center, is the individual Arab himself, so the individual. Surrounding that is the Arab's immediate family. Surrounding his immediate family, the next circle is the extended family, so that would be cousins, etc. Then the immediate geographic region. The fifth circle would be the country that he comes from. The sixth would be the Arab world. And the seventh would be the rest of the world, what they call in Arabic the war world. The Arab world is the world of peace. And the seventh circle, the rest of the world, we are the war mongers of the world. Then another very important thing, so obviously it all starts with the individual and with the immediate family. So the first place you need to look is the immediate family. And if you look at Arab parenting styles, I'll throw in the caveat one last time, which I am generalizing. In general, most Arab families have a very nurturing and indulgent mother, female figure, grandmother, female figures, and a very harsh disciplinarian father. And it's kind of a schizophrenic input, because on the one hand you have a very, very harsh, Arab children are consistently ending up in hospital because they've been beaten to within an inch of their lives by their fathers. And Arab mothers, on average, breastfeed their sons. They breastfeed their daughters for about 7 months. That's the average that an Arab would breastfeed a daughter. And they breastfeed their sons for about 5 years. So it's very indulgent. That means that the child could actually verbally ask to be breastfed. Figure a five-year-old kid could ask to be breastfed, and then he is, and he's never denied. It's considered a very bad social form for a mother to deny her child breast milk when he requests it. So this creates what Lawrence of Arabia spoke of when he said, with the Arab point of view, everything is either black or white, and there is no middle ground. And probably that comes from, and it's been described as a roller coaster type of behavior. You would see a very cool, self-controlled demeanor followed by an uncontrolled public outburst of emotion. And then right away back into that very calm mode. And that's very unusual for Western people. Like, there are some people we know that are very excitable, and there are some people we know that are very calm, but it's very unusual to see people jump back and forth like that. But then again, it's very unusual in Western cultures to have such different parenting styles impacting a child. So it's very, and also Arabs tend to, the reality is they tend to live in very close spaces, so the families are quite big, and they all live in a close space, so there's a lot, you trip over each other a lot, and the father is very present, in many cases unemployed, the mother is certainly unemployed, and so there's a lot of input from those two stimuli which are coming, the very, very strict, almost unpredictable discipline, and the absolute indulgence. And that's, that creates a very interesting dynamic. So then, moving out from that immediate family dynamic, there's the extended family. And in the extended family, a very interesting Arab, old Arab saying, which I think aptly describes a certain competitive and hostile interaction that people have, and it goes like this: I against my brother, my brother and I against our cousins, my brother, my cousins, and I against the world. It's so interesting that so the whole way that you interact with other people as you move out of those concentric circles is seen in terms of conflict. It's a belligerent interaction. It's not, so you don't, in the Western world, you create relationships for different reasons. we place a value on friendship, on socializing. We, in the Western world, place a high value on networking and creating business contacts, let's say. And that's how we would look at why we would create relationships. And a lot of the Arab world would look at creating relationships in terms of potential conflicts that we can have. And that's actually a goal of the relationship, not an unfortunate outcome of a relationship gone bad, as would be the case in Western culture. So then as we move further out to geography and country, there's the historical memory becomes very important. Very telling, when the Iran-Iraq war began, 20 odd years ago, there was an Arab what's that? 89. Yeah.
79.
89 is
79.
Okay.
Iran,
yeah. Yeah,
starting
79. Yeah, okay. 30 years. So they asked a historian, they said, how did this, battle start? And he was a big Arab historian, and he said, actually, it began with the Battle of Qadisiyah. Which is quite interesting, because the Battle of Qadisiyah was Muhammad's son-in-law Ali was defeated by the forerunners of the Sunni Arabs about 1,000 years ago. So that's the memory, right? Something happened 1,000 years ago. Now just compare that, let's say, to to the United States of America, where about 200 years ago, they had a civil war. And it was a war that killed more Americans than any other war that has been fought off American soil since then, or on American soil for that matter, since then. It was the most deadly war that America's ever fought. And yet, today, although most Americans, or many Americans, have ancestors that fought on opposite sides, nobody goes around, you know, I'm going to kill your daughter because your great-great-great-great-great-grandfather killed my great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, something. You know, we don't even think about it. Nobody in America bears a grudge for the Civil War today. It's just unheard of. You don't even think about it. And that's, you know, like 200 years ago. And then you look here at this Iran-Iraq war, and the guy says, well, it was, you know, a serious face. It wasn't Jay Leno or something. It was a serious face. And he says, you know, this war started 1,000 years ago. And that's the memory. So there's a very powerful historic memory. If somebody was hurt, this is passed on. They're very good storytellers, Arabs. And they pass on legends and stories from generation to generation. And they never die. They're not very literate. Spain, in any one year, the country of Spain publishes more books than have ever been published in Arabic in the history of the world. So they're not a very literate country. In many Arab countries, the literacy rate's about 3-4%. But they are very good at keeping historical memory alive through oral tales of what has happened. And of course, that has to factor into understanding the Arab mind. The next thing is self-control. Self-control is considered a value in the Western world. We would consider it something to aspire to, and, you know, discipline, self-control, etc. But there is no stigma in the Arab world placed on a person who loses control and becomes irate and emotional. It's not considered, unbecoming to just all of a sudden screech, like in the middle, I could just start screeching and howling at you and everything, and here you would all quickly get up and leave, and that'll be the end of this weekly class. But if I was giving this class in the Quran in Arabic in Saudi Arabia, for example, you would go, wow, he's good. We've got to bring a friend, come back. So obviously, there's a difference over there. So let me take a practical example of all of this and put it together and just show you how the contrast between how we would think about something and how an Arab would think about it. And I'm going to take the concept of zakat. Zakat is as follows, a very important principle of Islam. It's the third most important principle. So in Islam, Allah is great, is principle number one. Muhammad is his prophet, is principle number two. And principle number three is the principle of zakat. So it's pretty high up there. What would zakat mean? Well, it's an important principle in Islam that everything belongs to God. There's nothing material that belongs to a human being. And wealth is therefore only entrusted in human hands because God has somehow blessed you and entrusted you with this wealth. But it's really God's wealth, and you are just a custodian and a caretaker of that wealth. And the word zakah actually means, in Hebrew and in Arabic, it means purification. And in Arabic, it also means growth. And the idea there is that our possessions are purified by, like, cutting them. Like, if you would prune a tree or cut a tree to encourage its growth, by giving away zakah, by giving away your wealth, you actually encourage your wealth to grow, because it's not yours to start off with. So by cutting it away, you realize that, then God sees that you're a good custodian, Allah sees you're a good custodian, and he gives you that wealth. What does this sound like? Any Jewish concept that springs to mind? Tzedakah. Yeah.
Well, also about the idea of kochiva mensyadi, that you don't...
Absolutely. This sounds exactly like tzedakah, because tzedakah, they even sound the same, zakah and tzedakah. But the tzedakah actually does not mean charity. Tzedakah means righteousness, the correct thing to do, the proper thing to do. What does that mean? That means that your money doesn't really belong to you in Judaism. It belongs to God. Your wealth is on loan to you. You're the custodian of it. And therefore, you have to do the right and proper thing to show that you are a worthy custodian to support the impoverished, the less fortunate than us. And that is the mitzvah, the commandment of tzedakah. Doesn't it sound the same? Now, if you would make the mistake that most Western people make, you will say zakah equals tzedakah, and what you understand as charity and contributing to people who need is what an Arab would understand when his imam encourages him to fulfill the third principle of Islam and to give zakah. And you would be dead wrong. In Haiti, the earthquake that devastated Haiti, the West, led by the great Satan, America, opened its checkbook, its pocketbook, and gave tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to Haiti. The American government itself pledged $90 million of public funds, which was about 44% of the total given by all world governments. And America was going through the beginnings of the global financial crisis at the time, and yet the private donations were far more generous than the American government's generous donation was. So that's despite unemployment, widespread unemployment, despite the depression starting, etc. The money was sent for humanitarian aid, for rebuilding Haiti, etc. So what did the Muslim world do? How much zakah did they donate? Okay, 0.01% of the total donations given by governments came from Arab governments, which is basically a rounding error for a Saudi Arabian prince in a weekend in Las Vegas. That's a kind of what they gave in the end. So Iran, for example, was very generous. They kicked in $50,000. That's less than a few cents per... That's less than a cent per Saudi Arabian citizen. Far less than a cent, yeah. So an oil-drenched country like Saudi Arabia, who practices the principle of zakat, why did they not fulfill their obligatory benevolence, and why do they lag so far behind the greedy West, the great Satan?
They didn't even give to the earthquakes in Indonesia, where they're the same religion.
Correct. I just don't have statistics on that one, so that's why I'm only quoting what I have statistics on. So there's a book called The Reliance of the Traveler. It's a classic manual of Islamic law. It was written, compiled by a renowned Muslim jurisprudent by the name of Ahmed ibn Naqib al-Misri in the 14th century. And this guy says, it says over there, and all the Arab world agrees that this is the Shulchan Aruch, so to speak, the code of law that Arabs that guide Arabs in their religious practice. It says quite clearly, it is not permissible to give zakat to a non-Muslim. And if you dig a little bit deeper into the commentaries, you see that zakat is actually only intended for one purpose, to convert infidels. So for that purpose, so let's say if the late Osama bin Laden would hold out his hand and say, listen, I need some money to help kill infidels and convert them to Islam and to make Sharia law prevalent, he would probably get a lot of zakat at that point in time. So, am I a racist by saying all these things? Well, first of all, before I get into am I a racist, so just to show you that zakah and tzedakah are very different, even though at first they might sound the same, and that's the danger. When people start speaking about humanitarian aid and oppressors and things like that, we have to understand what that means. We have to understand about Arab hyperbole and how they exaggerate things. So, if you bump into a person by mistake on the tram, they'll say, "You are an oppressor. You're driving me off this out of this tram. You're stealing my space on the tram, and et cetera, et cetera. And that would be quite colorful language and very... Now, a Westerner would be horrified at that. Like, how could you do that to this person? But they don't really understand. All you did was, while you were shuffling past, you bumped them. It's a different... You know, it's you use the same kind of words using human language, but it has totally different meaning. So, there was a... Very interesting television program in Israel, where they got a woman to dress up like an Arab in a hijab, and she was an actress, and they got a man to act as a shopkeeper, and the woman came into the shop. They had hidden cameras. The woman comes into the shop and she orders a coffee. And the shopkeeper, who's an actor also, says, "We don't serve your kind in this establishment." And the whole thing is to see how the other patrons will react to the other customers will react to this. And of course, they react in beautiful, typical Jewish fashion. They are outraged. And some of them say, "Well, if you're not prepared to serve her, you're not serving me," and they walk out. And there's one woman, she's all quiet, she doesn't protest as much as the others, but she just waits her turn, then she gets up, she buys a coffee, she walks over to the Arab woman, gives her coffee to the Arab woman, walks out into the parking lot, sits in her car and starts crying. And then the producers come over and they see her crying over there. You know, so that is they were trying to test, are Israelis racist? would they discriminate against? And there was a very revealing comment that somebody made, and he said that there is no symmetry in Israel. You're not able to create this same video with a Jew walking with his kippah on into a shop in Ramallah or Jenin. So let's create symmetry, this man said, and then we'll comment on this. But it definitely sparked a huge discussion in Israel. There was a big uproar, and it was very front and center. Everybody was talking about it, and talking about attitudes that Jews have towards Arabs. So the question is, you know, there was a time before I was born when hitchhiking was a very common way of making your way around America, the United States, and South Africa, where I was born. People would hitchhike. Young people would go off and they would hitchhike. And then what happened is that some people stabbed the people who gave them lifts and robbed them, and a few terrible incidents happened. Now, does that mean every hitchhiker is a serial killer? No. There was one or two people who did bad things, and then all of a sudden the culture became that nobody gives a ride to anybody anymore. Is that racist, discriminatory? No. It's a reflection of, it's a natural instinct to protect that which we have. So in Israel, there used to be a lot of Arab workers, and that has become far more rare. Very few Arab workers, they used to work in construction, etc. Now Israeli companies do not hire them for those tasks. Is that discriminatory, or is that just being protecting ourselves because some Arabs, not all, have turned out to be terrorists and have inflicted tremendous pain and damage and suffering on Jewish people? So I want to say that anything I've said over here, just to try and highlight some of the differences of the way that people think, is not, I'm not making any value judgments. Obviously, I am Western and I think in a certain way, and so I will place my children's life, for example, on a very high pedestal, and I will judge a person negatively who considers his child's life to be worthless. But that is, having said that, I'm not. It's not being racist to understand the Arab mentality and then to react in certain ways and to put certain things in place, mechanisms in place, to protect our people from potential negative outcomes that could come from those attitudes that are very deeply held and very passionately held. All right. I was going to go into something else, but I'll just conclude at this point and then you can attack me and do whatever you want. With a quote from Andrew McCarthy, who wrote in the National Review, and he said, "I'm not optimistic about reform in the Muslim world succeeding, because too many of its champions, the champions for reform in the Western world, in the Muslim world, seem to think denial is an adequate substitute for confronting and refuting Islam's unsavory aspects." You know, in California, there's a city called Orange County, and Orange County, they have an under 12 girls soccer team, and they called them the Orange County Crusaders, just the name of the team. And the name was considered highly offensive to the Muslim population, which is a very small population of Muslims in Orange County. And so they complained, and the team changed its name to the Orange County Lions, or Lionesses, something. Anyway, Orange County Lions, I think, in order not to offend the Muslim population, which I'm all in favor of that. Why offend somebody if you don't have to? That's part of my Western sensitivity. I don't like to offend people. But the irony of it is that there were two other sports teams in Orange County. One was called, with Muslim sports players on them, one was called the Orange County Jihadists, and the other were called the Orange County Mujahideens. And those stayed. And you see, that is the great fear that I have for Western culture and civilization. Because the Arab, consciously or unconsciously in some cases, are using our sensitivities and our greatness, actually, in my opinion, against us and to harm us. So where they're using our sense of political correctness and inclusion, they use it, although they don't share that, you know, Sharia, there's very clear demarcations. Like I said, the last circle is the world of peace, the Muslim world, and the world of war, everyone else. So there's a very clear demarcation, but we don't make that demarcation. So, you know, many of you know that I'm a very keen martial artist, and I can tell you that when you spar with somebody in martial arts, if you walk, it's all a mind game, it's all mental. If you walk into the octagon or the ring, and you are like, oh, I'm going to lose, this guy's so strong, he's so much better than me, he trained harder than I did and everything, I'll tell you, you're going to lose. No matter what the reality is, no matter if you are 10 times his weight and height and strength, and you have 10 times as much skill as him, you will lose. And if he comes in and says, I'm going to beat this person, I'm in this battle to finish him off or whatever, that's the guy's going to win. That is the reality of how these things work. The Muslim population is at war with us, but we are not at war with them because of our historical perspectives and viewpoints about these things. So we don't understand the threat, we don't understand that we're at war, and we don't understand the enemy, which gives the enemy a tremendous advantage because they will strike and have stricken first, and they have first strike advantage over us. And that's the great fear that many people have. They have a birth rate of over 6, which means that an average woman has more than 6 children in the Islamic world, and we in the Western world have a birth rate of 1.4, and you need 2.2 to just replace yourself, not grow. So they are a growing population, they are an increasingly radicalized population, and all of these things that I've been discussing are going back into this big recipe to create a very great danger and grave danger for Western civilization. And I think that the first step is that we have to be aware that we're dealing with something that is not ourselves, and we should not project ourselves on there and say, well, we want peace at all costs, so they would also want peace at all costs. That's not necessarily the case. For them, an ideal and a value could be to not have peace. And so that's my take-home message for today. I think I'll stick with it unless you can come up with any arguments that can throw me off my game. Questions, comments, concerns?
It's a shame they view our good will and all that as a weakness.
They view our goodwill as a weakness, yes.
As a sign of weakness.
Yeah. You know, the closest... now I'm going to really sound racist. No, I'm not going to say that. there are many... okay, let me say this. I am horrified, absolutely horrified, and I don't know why the various organizations that should be screaming from the rafters are not doing this. I'm horrified at the oppression of Muslim women. Yeah. There it is. You have no, I don't think we have a clue of how difficult and harsh and awful the lot of most Muslim women is in this world. They are slaves and worse, and they are abused in the most awful ways imaginable, and they have no recourse to, they have no rights, they have no recourse, they may not leave their home even unless they're accompanied by a close male relative, they cannot drive, they cannot vote, needless to say, etc., etc. And that's something that must be addressed. I mean, that is the greatest travesty of justice that exists in the world today, and I don't understand why people are not just screaming about this, and they're not. There's a deafening silence as by and large. Having said that, there are many Muslim women who are very happy in abusive relationships. It's a weird thing to say. But when they have been taken, rescued, in my opinion, from these abusive relationships and found themselves in environments that were much more nurturing and much more compassionate, they actually were not happy. They were unhappy. So it's definitely true what you're saying, that in a large part of the Muslim world, strength is almost like an iron hand, an iron fist, is admired and seen as a great point of strength. Every capitulation, every concession is seen as a weakness and as something to, and makes them lose admiration. You know, if I had a boss that screamed at me constantly and insulted me and demeaned me, I would leave. That would be, something I just couldn't live with. But there are some people that when you're nice to them and kind to them and give a lot of flexibility and leeway, they find it very hard to operate under those circumstances. And again, it comes to this, what we do is we project our own value system on other people and we expect them to behave like we would behave. So if somebody would come with an olive branch of friendship to me and say, listen, I'll give you land and I'll give you money and economic relations with our country and everything like that, I would go, wow, this is a part, this is somebody we can live with. These are good neighbors. But if you conversely would tell me, but to the Arabs, every concession that Israel makes does not have that necessarily, has not historically had that same kind of resonance in the Arab world. And they've only asked for more concessions and have escalated violence and not created possibilities for peace to exist. So we have to understand that it's a different mentality, and therefore we need to treat that mentality in ways that are appropriate for that.
That's why the Arab world's full of dictatorships.
Correct, and that's why, there's a great point. The so-called Arab Spring, all these Arabs are wonderful things because these tyrannical dictatorships are being overthrown by the people. But again, we're thinking like Americans, because in 1776 with the American Revolution, where they threw off oppressive British rule, that created the greatest superpower the world has ever seen. It created the greatest democracy, a stable environment, a wonderful life for millions of people, a home for Jews after the Holocaust. I mean, on and on and on. It's been an incredible success. So we think that all revolutions, because there we go with our Western mentality again, end up creating stability and democracy and freedom and all these things we value. That's not true. If you look, count up all the revolutions in history and see how many ended up like the American Revolution and how many ended up like the Russian Revolution or exactly, or some of those examples, the French Revolution, you know, it ushered in an era of turbulence no stability and so on. So we have to not think like Western people, even in terms of this, but everyone's so excited that there's this Arab Spring, and I am very nervous because his history does not bode well. This is not going to end well, if history is anything to go by. Why did I say that? Somebody made a comment, and did you want to say something?
Can I say this? One of your themes was that political correctness can lead to sort of a cultural suicide.
Yes.
And it sounds like you give, which is a little less emotive, if you propose giving this speech to a wider audience. Let's take Arabs out of the equation altogether and look at the subcontinent in the 1800s and until the early 20th century. There, in Hindu populations, sati was a traditional funeral rite of Hindus, where the perfectly healthy widow of the deceased would also be immolated on his funeral pyre.
Mm.
Now, there were many European colonial powers back then, which included the Danes, the English, there's a whole heap of them. You could Google on it, you'll find it, just Google on say. And we're living in a progressive age now where you celebrate cultural diversity. Back then they had a little bit more, a little bit more cultural justified chauvinism, because the colonial power said, what you're doing, as far as we're concerned, is barbaric. You shouldn't take the life of a perfectly healthy widow. If you want to continue that religious rite, continue doing it, but we'll hang everybody that engages in it.
Mm.
So where we're different, I think, today is that the Western world, I think, needs sometimes to say, if you want to come into our societies, I mean, there you've got a whole argument about colonialism, they went there, vice versa. Just drawing a parallel, and I think this parallel can be drawn, it seems to me that the problem that's really animating you, what dangers confronting Western society now, is that by making so many accommodations and celebrating every cultural diversity, we're at risk of losing our own traditional Western value. And the fact is, the great Western liberal democracies are based on Judeo-Christian principles.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we need to be so coy about wanting to preserve them. I mean, you mentioned the example about changing team names in California. I think there's a much, much better example in California, where because of cultural sensitivity of the Muslim population, they've taken off the cross, the Christian cross, off the, I think it's the coat of arms of California.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say to a graduating class, God bless you anymore.
Yeah. In a public school.
I have a problem with that. On one hand, being culturally sensitive is a wonderful thing, but we have to be very careful to commit cultural suicide. And the Western world is often, if you look at Europe at the moment, it's all driven by demography. What you said about Western the birth rates in Western countries is true. Europe, the birth rates range between about 1.2 to about 1.4, 1.5, and that's below zero population growth. So you've got aging populations in all of those countries, whereas you've got an aging population, you've only got two options. You either become an economic basket case, because you don't have a workforce ultimately to pay for all the social services you require for an aging population, or you have to create the workforce. If you're not producing the children yourself, you must import.
Well, you can outsource them. Mm-hmm. You outsource your birthing.
So that's why in Europe today you've got the Muslim immigration there are the children they're not having.
Exactly.
So they, if they don't want economic basket cases, they must have immigration.
Yes.
They must have. And
yes.
The only, as you say, the only culture in today's world which is producing an excess, not right throughout the Arab world, I might say, but certain parts of Africa, and Iran, for example, actually the birth rate's gone to about 1.4,
yeah,
very, very low.
Yeah. Certain
Europeans, in one generation, gone from 6 children to 1.4 children, I think it's quite remarkable.
But still, you know, in Europe, the number one name for male children born in Europe today is Muhammad.
Yeah, well, just to give you a couple of the statistics that I actually do happen to know, at the moment in France, only 10% of Frenchmen are Muslim,
right.
But 35% of Frenchmen under the age of 20.
Exactly.
So if you if you project forward a generation, within, I don't know, 30, 50 years, France, which is a nuclear power, will be an Islamic country.
Right, because it's a democracy, it's a democracy it will.
In the United States, you know...
Lovely to meet you, right. Yeah, I don't know.
If you look at the population under the age of 4, it's a non-white, non-Anglo population. It's Hispanic, and so the ethnic character of the United States will change for similar reasons.
But that's fine. Nothing wrong with ethnic
character. No, I'm just saying...
Yeah, nothing wrong, yeah.
It's a tiny sense, but I have a problem with... I have a problem with some of your analysis. I mean, I think your observations and some of the conclusions are reasonable in terms of cultural sensitivity and cultural suicide, etc. But I think, you know, essentially you're making a comparison between the Islamic Arab mindset world and the Western world. And I think you have to be careful in how much of the difference you ascribe to things that are essential about Islam or about the Arab, because there are lots of confounding variables that I think if you don't take them into account, you make an error. So, for example, you're looking in a large part of the Arab world at essentially a feudal or recently post-feudal society compared to, you know, the post-Enlightenment Western world, which is a largely middle-class industrialized society with a long tradition of democracy. So, you know, if you went back to feudal Europe or if you go to India and look at, you know, pre-democratic practices or even current practices there, there are lots of societies where there are significant issues in terms of parental and maternal behaviours, lots of issues in terms of male-female relationship, the rights of women, attitudes to the other, family and clan orientation. I think they're very common in the pre-bourgeois-industrialised world.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're essentially doing is comparing two societies in different stages in evolution. And although some of what you say may be quite true, if you don't allow for that confounding factor, you could be ascribing characteristics to the Islamic world that are just a representative of the phase that they're currently in. So I think you just have to dig down that level deeper before you should be comfortable making those very easy judgments. And I'm not denying the observations and the behaviours, and that some of the behaviours are very dangerous to Western values. I'm just saying we've got to perhaps question a little bit harder what the mechanism is. And, you know, I guess if you look at any traditional society, if you look at, you know, Jewish religious attitudes to the non-Jew, I mean, it's a complex issue, but there's certainly, you can go looking at the texts and find and quote things that would not be comfortable to the modern secular mind. Mm. I just want to bring that caveat.
Yeah, thank you. I am very comforted and inspired by your remarks, and I pray that is what you said is the great hope for a solution. Because if I understood correctly what you said, there were times when Western culture was not so well behaved, shall we say, as we are now. And we have grown, matured, progressed to the point that we are now. With some warts and everything, you know, we also have our problems, but we're better off than we were 200 years ago as a society. And so hopefully the Islamic world, the Arab world, Islamic world is going through their teenage rebellious period, and when they grow up and become adults, they will mature and that will be the solution.
No,
I hope.
Can I just say one thing? Well, finish what you want to say. Is that what you were saying?
Is that your...
Look, I don't know how much they'll grow. I mean, I cannot predict anything. All I'm suggesting is that if you attribute the central characteristics to the Islamic and Arabic nature of the societies, in terms of how it comes across, it can be misconstrued in ways, in terms of racism, I'm not suggesting it. I think careful how you put these things in. And when you start talking about, you know, Islamic families not valuing their children's lives, I become very uncomfortable, you know, getting an anecdote. And so that's a separate thing. But I can't predict where this evolutionary process will go. They may get stuck at this stage for the next 150 years.
My God.
I'm just suggesting that there are features of what you're describing in their society that you could probably have observed in feudal Christendom and in other, you know, pre-modern societies. And even though they're now, you know, they're technologically developing, et cetera, et cetera, they are recently feudal, in large part.
Look, it's always a risk whenever you're trying to put across this type of topic in 35, 40 minutes, there's always, you know, you're risking generalizations and, you know, I try to make the caveat, but obviously... I agree with you. There are many Muslim people, families that I know, where they treasure their children as much as I do.
So I'm not trying to make the point that there are exceptions to the rule. Which is another valid point. It's a more fundamental issue. I think that as soon as you say, look, this is what we're observing, and furthermore, I'm ascribing these features to the fact that these are Arabs and Muslims, as soon as you make that connection, and don't allow a more subtle analysis. I think.
How many suicide bombers were not Islamic?
I'm not disputing observations you're making. You know,
I'll tell you what my observations come from. We are constantly, I am constantly, and other people even maybe more so than me, constantly shocked by certain behavior. We see beheadings, we see suicide bombers and that, and we go, how could that
happen? Have you seen
drawn
people being drawn and quartered in pre-modern European society?
No, but he's got a point. The way you sort of demonstrate the example in the most graphic ways to say this, one in four Palestinian Arabs is Christian. There has been approximately 119 suicide bombings to the end of last year. I think that's the figure, about 119 suicide bombings.
Not
a single one
in Israel.
Christian. Yet the Christian Palestinian Arabs are just as occupied as Muslim Arabs. So what that teaches us is, and you would say, that the brutality we see emanating from Muslim Arabs is not a function of the occupation per se, it's a question of ideology. Christians don't have that ideology, therefore the violence doesn't flow from it.
Can I suggest one? So just on that point, and I'm not sure the facts here, but my suspicion, for example, if you look at the Christians, the Copts in Egypt, they represent a different socioeconomic demographic to the Islamic Egyptian population. I just wonder whether the Christians represent a class trading group. I just don't know that they represent the same social stratum as the...
I've been to Israel many, many times. I don't have figures, but I can only go off what I've observed myself. The Christian Arabs, the Christian Palestinians in cities such as Nazareth and Beit Lechem, which were traditionally Christian cities, are now subjugated. You know, they are not in positions where they rule the roost anymore.
Sure.
So I don't think that they are in the higher socio-economic classes, which would normally, what goes hand in hand with the higher socio-economic class, is to be able to actually prevail.
I think they'd be marginalised, but I just wonder whether...
I just venture
that as a hypothesis that maybe the Christians have a different approach. A, because they're marginalised in the broad community, but B, because they maybe have traditionally come from a different class structure than Islam.
Which is the case
for the Christian Egyptians.
The reason I don't agree with that is that it's too stark a statistic. Out of 119 suicide bombers, when 25% of Palestinian Arabs are Christian, not to have a single... You would expect there to be 25% of 119 bombers would be Christian, whereas in fact none of them is.
Yeah.
But the other thing which I think you would benefit from, and it's really the point that my friend here was making, is that you should make the point, I think, that the norm throughout the history of man is not the liberal democracy that we all take for granted.
No,
the norm throughout history has been oppression, anomaly, class-based societies, brutality, subjugation of women, all of the things which we rail against.
Yeah.
We're the aberration in the world.
Yes.
Liberal democracy is the aberration. We only have been here for a couple of hundred years.
I agree. I wouldn't
put on principles that are thousands of years old.
I mean, we are an aberration. I understand what you mean there, but I think it's something very precious and needs to be protected. So it needs to be vigilantly and proactively protected. And what I was saying is that because we exist in this milieu of a liberal democracy, we are not vigorously protecting it because we don't consider it to be under threat or attack. While there is a very large segment of the world's population that does really want to attack and destroy what we hold to be precious, and it is fragile because it is an aberration and it hasn't been around all these years. So I that's just my point. My point is when we respect that there are different outlooks, and then we look at, you know, the part that I skipped because we ran out of time, I have quotes here from different Islamic leaders and political and religious leaders speaking in Arabic in their own words.
No, I don't think you need to translate a word. I'm sure we're well enough read to know the sorts of things that you would have
right.
to say.
Well, that's a lot of suicide bombers are in London, the ones that the bombers in London,
the underground.
They were medical doctors and students, so I don't think they come. They are now men and women, almost equal amounts.
We're
all university educated, so I don't know if it's
correlation
between education and social status. And
gets more complex. I mean, there's ideology and other issues.
Yeah.
Anything else to go? The only other point
I like your points because they're very thought provoking.
For those sections of the European. Western European community and the North American community now, who are most sympathetic to the sort of concerns you're raising, you know, the right on the in Europe and the other people are making the noise about this Islamicization.
Right.
Unfortunately, those people who most endorse this concern are the people who weren't very friendly to us, in the middle of the last century. It's an unfortunate.
Really, I don't.
Yeah, I think that the groups in European society who are most sympathetic to this issue are on the right. They're the groups that are speaking out.
That's correct, but we suffered from
they are the right,
the left.
It's the same right who weren't too friendly to us in the, you know, if you look at their philosophical forebears a couple of generations ago would have been saying the same things about Jews.
I think it's not unreasonable,
I don't know if you agree, but
I gave a class
coming from the same end of the philosophical spectrum.
I gave a class here called Liberal, Labour or Greens, What Would God Vote? How Would God Vote? And the beginning of that lecture, not to go into the whole thing now, but the beginning of it is I gave a definition of left and right. And I think maybe we need to define left and right. And according to that definition that I gave then, I would think I would paint certainly the communist movements and even a very strong argument could be made for the Nazi movement, etc., were extreme leftist movements by that, by my definition, which is kind of a nuanced definition, don't have time for now. And on the right would be people who are for us. But, you know, I come from Canada. In Canada there's a Liberal Party, which is like our Labour, it's on the left. And there's the Conservatives, which are on the right, like our Liberal Party. And under every Jew, here's another generalization, every Jew votes Liberal. They said you could run a goat in there's a Jewish area in Montreal, and they said a goat could run for the Liberal Party and would win because the Jews will automatically.
The Jews have always been in the vanguard of all socialist movements.
Yes, they have, exactly. Now, if you look at the voting record in the UN under Liberal governments in Canada, they abstained or voted against Israel as often as they voted for Israel, or maybe more often. If you look at the Conservative government under Stephen Harper today, he votes always for Israel, unequivocally, and he condemned the flotilla a year ago, and he supported Israel in the Lebanon War, and in the Operation Cast Lead. So to his own political detriment, because there are far more Muslim voters in Canada than there are Jewish. So he's doing it because of principled reasons. And if one looks at Bush versus Obama, let's say, where there's another right and left divide, according to my definition, Bush was far more friendly to. And I knew it before, because my definition of left and right almost never fails to produce predictable outcomes. Those that are on the left of the spectrum, like the Nazis, the communists, and Obama in that same breath, but you know, it's a spectrum, so he's a little bit more to the center. And those that are on the right, like Bush and Harper and others, are the Tea Partiers and all those guys. They are very, very pro-Israel, very pro-Israel. And so I don't agree with that point. I don't see that they're the ideological fathers of the same. It's just, you have to define right and left, though.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.